Hey, everybody. Before we get to today's podcast, Brandon and I want to tell you about something exciting that maybe you've heard of, maybe you haven't. It's a new project that we've launched that we're offering to you called Intensive Care Academy.
Yes, ICA is now live. It is a web-based, video-based teaching platform. Many ways similar to this podcast, but it is videos, it is a little more structured and more rigorous and more comprehensive, and it's just another way for us to teach critical care. So if you're interested in this, we think you might be interested in that. Currently, what you'll find there is the Foundations program, which is over 50 lessons intended to orient somebody new to critical care, kind of targeted at the new critical care APP, like a NP or a PA starting critical care with no prior training, kind of going through everything from A to Z, from diseases to treatments to diagnosis to procedures. And we're going to continue to have new content all the time for different folks. You'll also get access to two new private podcast feeds, one with audio versions of the lessons to review, and ICA Pearls, which is the new home for the Turbos, which are leaving the free podcast here. Also, live Q&A sessions with us and a lot more. If that interests you, and we're hoping it will, go check it out, ICU101.com. It's ICU101. And let us know what you think.
Now, on with the podcast.
Hey, everyone. I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
Welcome back to the podcast. I'm Brian Bowling with you, and with me, as always, is Brandon Odo.
Hello.
We thought we would talk a little bit about the right heart today. So the right heart doesn't get as much love, I think, as the left heart, but it's not the same. It's a different entity. But we're going to talk about it and why you should care about it. We're going to get a little bit into the weeds with stuff, so hopefully you have a decent understanding of how things work and some basic echo and basic, cardiac physiology. But we thought we'd bring somebody in to really help us, and who better than longtime guest, friend of the podcast, the one and only Matt Shuba. Matt is at the Cleveland Clinic up in Cleveland, and he does medical ICU there, and also is doing some new stuff in the cath lab with some right heart caths and right heart stuff. So he's the perfect guy to bring on board to kind of walk us through this. So welcome back, Matt.
Thanks, guys. Great to be here again.
Matt, you did one or two recent talks elsewhere talking about some topics with the right heart and echo and how to assess it. And I really wanted to dive into this with you because, first of all, you're the perfect person for it. And I think it's a confusing area to a lot of people, maybe even because it's this area where we have like a overabundance of tools and that leaves people not knowing kind of which ones to use. So I want to just give you a rough skeleton of a case and we could dive into it. We're just going to say you have a critically ill adult patient in your ICU who's in shock, on pressors, on the vent. And like many of these patients, perhaps you're applying ultrasound to try to understand their hemodynamics a little bit better. Maybe you think that there is some sort of a cardiogenic element to their shock. Maybe the right heart is involved. You know, who knows? Maybe there's even a chronic element, if there is some involvement of the right heart, in addition to an acute one. So we're still in the kind of exploratory phase of understanding this patient. And we're going to maybe use ultrasound to try to better understand them. Before we get into some of the tools for doing that, I want to just give you the chance to frame this for us. So give me just like a one-liner to orient us to, like, philosophically or conceptually, how you think we should be approaching assessing the right heart in a, you know, sick patient who perhaps is in shock using ultrasound.
Yeah, it's a great point. Thanks for bringing all these ideas to the fore, guys. I think the easiest way that I can conceptualize what you should be looking at when you're looking at a right heart to determine whether it's part of the shock, whether it's primary cause or secondary contributor, is a simplistic way to think about it is three terms. So size, squeeze, and septal kinetics. And that's the starting point for integrating the information that you're going to see on ultrasound. So size, being size relative to the left ventricle, obviously it should be smaller. Usually the ratio is about 1/3 RV, 2/3 LV for the total, you know, ventricular compartment. And then squeeze is whatever metric of systolic function that you're going to use. I'm sure we'll talk about those in more detail. And then finally, septal kinetics. Is this right heart dysfunction significant enough that it's impairing the motion of the intraventricular septum? Is the septum bowing into the LV, which is often a critically unstable situation?
Okay. So this is starting to get into the realm where I think people can get confused. Talk about, I guess, size first. There's at least two things you could look at here, and maybe they're not the same, but one would be just be able to look at the RV, right? How large it is, maybe compared to the left heart. And maybe the other is the what the septum looks like. Is it, you know, bowing into the LV and flattening out? Are those different, or are those saying something very similar and kind of have overlapping roles here?
So I think as the size increases, you're going to be more likely to have septal dyskinesia because your two ventricles are operating in a constrained compartment, being the pericardium. But I think dilation you'll see first, whether it's mild or moderate, you'll see that first, sometimes before you'll see the septal dyskinesia. And that's usually a reflection that there's some sort of acute insult that has caused the RV to need to excessively use the Starling mechanism. In other words, it's trying to increase the preload and the stretch to the extent possible to maintain the cardiac output. So those are sort of the early stages, and you can get away with some degree of that. But anytime you see to talk about these things as, you know, if the heart, different sides of the heart have a purpose, you know, the idea would be to try to regain its normal geometry. So if you start to become dilated and it's persistently dilated, that's abnormal. Some sort of short-term dilation in the setting of an acute insult, like let's say you crank the PEEP way up above the level that is beneficial to the patient, or there's a, you know, acute PE or something, you will see some dilation there, but you'd like to see the heart use its compensatory mechanisms to sort of reshape and resize the right heart down to closer to a normal size. So I think anytime you see dilation, it's abnormal. The question is it acute, chronic, and is it worsening? And then once you get to the point that you have this beyond, you know, sort of a mild or moderate degree, you may see sort of impingement of the RV into the LV, where you actually lose LV stroke volume as a result.
Okay, so dilation is probably the earliest finding in most cases that you'll see and can be part of a compensatory mechanism. So you could be dilated but still having, you know, good function and output. But if you start to see that flattening of the septum, that's probably a somewhat later finding. And I mean, that per se is not compensatory. So you might say it's kind of an early sign of actual failure or decompensation?
Yeah, I think so. Some of the definitions that circulate in the critical care literature use septal dyskinesia as part of the diagnostic criteria for acute core pulmonale to signify that's a more advanced stage. Now, obviously, there are people with chronic pulmonary hypertension who are walking around with septal dyskinesia all the time, but it's all about the context. Just like, you know, there are people that walk around with a LVEF of 10%. They're not necessarily in shock. It just depends on, you know, it depends on the contextual factors.
Okay. Now, some people will look at when the septum is bowing and maybe say if it's happening during systole, that's more associated with a pressure overload on the RV. And if it's during diastole, it's more of a volume change. First of all, I don't know how accurate or reliable that is. But second of all, how does that fit into this? I mean, I at least tend to not really know what to do with those findings, even if I'm able to make the distinction. But
yeah, you know, I think a lot of the time when you see a true acute right heart, if there's septal dyskinesia, it's probably very likely going to involve some element of both, or if it's acute on chronic, it'll involve some element of both. The interesting thing, though, that might be helpful is sometimes if you have somebody that has underlying chronic pulmonary hypertension and then you develop some sort of insult that causes them to be hypovolemic, you may lose or diminish some of that diastolic component of the septal dyskinesia. So you still have the systolic part because their PA systolic pressure is sky high. And just as a function of the pulmonary vascular resistance. But the preload component obviously is dynamic. So if you have somebody, you know, with C. diff colitis who's had 12 bowel movements in a day and they happen to have pulmonary hypertension on top of that, they may lose that diastolic component. So that's kind of a nice little nuance in that very sort of subselected population. Now, that's not going to apply to most people you meet. And I agree, once you see it, septal dyskinesia is bad. When it's happening, probably less relevant. And a lot of the times it'll be in systole and diastole.
Okay. So in principle, you might be able to distinguish these and I guess kind of use them to separate out preload versus afterload changes. But in practice, there's enough overlap that many times they will not be separable.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the kind of in the realm of dilation. In the realm of function and contractility, there's a whole mess of tools that can help you assess here. Probably the most common one that a lot of people will use is the TAPSE, right? Measuring how much the tricuspid annular plane is going up and down with each contraction. What's your brief take on TAPSE? Do you think it is a, if people are going to use maybe one tool for this, it can be the EF of the RV?
Yeah, That actually is a nice segue into what I was going to say is, you know, the measurement that we'd really like to know would be an RVEF. And that's not something that we can practically do at the bedside. I don't have 3D echo at the bedside, and I don't even know how accurate that is.
That's just because the RV is too complex of a shape to really eyeball the function.
Correct.
Like that. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, you just can't measure it, right? Because with the LV, which is rather relatively bullet shaped, you can kind of do a two dimensional measurement in two planes and then get yourself an EF. But there's the dimensions and the geometry of the RV don't really allow for that. So you'd have to do that with like a, you know, cardiac MRI or something, which I mean, I've never gotten one in a critically ill patient. Probably not many people have. So we look for surrogates then of RVEF, which, you know, things like TAPSE or other longitudinal measurements of RV function correlate really well with that. So that's something that's why that's a useful measurement. The other thing is it's relatively repeatable. You know, you can do it, you know, fairly consistently. Obviously, there's some technical limitations if you have a foreshortened view or if you're looking at it from an RV-focused four-chamber view versus a normal four-chamber view, you might have slight differences. I think the important thing for the bedside clinician is to do it the same way every time, that you're taking care of the same patient so that you can at least compare your measurements within, you know, your own measurements. And then, you know, obviously, if your colleagues do it similarly to you, that would be helpful as well. So I think it's a useful measurement. The question is, what does it represent? And similarly, you know, not to get too philosophical, what does LVEF represent if we're talking about the LV? It's not exactly contractility, right? It's an integration of contractility and the loading conditions of the heart, both the preload and the afterload conditions. So in a way, it tells you about the functioning of the RV pulmonary arterial unit, which is useful. Because a lot of the patients we meet, we don't actually know why the RV is dysfunctional. Now, most of the patients we take care of, though, it's usually an afterload problem, right? It's usually an acute pulmonary hypertension, whether it's related to a PE, ARDS, the way we're ventilating the patient, things like that, or if it's from left-sided heart failure. But it's usually not an isolated RV contractility issue unless you're dealing with an RV infarct. Like, that's the least common scenario. So what the reason that I think this is appealing then about TAPSE is it tells you about the function of the unit more than it tells you about the function of the heart. And the function of the unit is really what you want to know, because if you apply a treatment to lower the pulmonary vascular resistance, let's say, the TAPSE should change, it should improve. Or if you apply a treatment to improve the contractility, like let's say you give an inotrope, assuming there's contractile reserve of this heart, it should increase. So it's not exactly a contractility measurement. It integrates both the contractility components and the afterloading components, which is, you know, to use a term that we throw around a lot, that's RVPA coupling, or how well the energy is being transferred from the right heart to the pulmonary circulation and how energetically efficient that is. And that's what makes TAPSE appealing, because it's an okay integration of those factors.
Okay. So to make the analogy back to the left heart, if someone looks at the LV and says the EF is 25% and this says something about the LV, And yet if you then, let's say, drop their systemic vascular resistance by half and dramatically drop their arterial blood pressure, and now their EF is 45%, you haven't changed the heart per se. It's just that it's contracting much better with better loading conditions. And the same thing applies to the right heart here. We shouldn't look at a TAPSE or anything else as some inherent characteristics of the heart. That plays a role, but so does the conditions that it's in.
Right. It's kind of like the intersection of those two factors, like the afterload conditions and the contractility. That's kind of the integration of them. So it's still very, very useful, and it will change acutely. Just like you mentioned, I mean, you can improve somebody's LVEF by putting them on a systemic vasodilator within hours, right? You don't have to wait 6 months to do a new echo. You can see that acutely. And the same is true for the TAPSE.
What about the preload? Does that affect measurements like the TAPSE?
You know, it's going to be in some ways preload dependent, because it depends, you know, the sort of there's on two, you know, from two aspects. But I think the main way it's going to affect it is if you have excess preload, then you kind of get in that situation once you're quote unquote falling off the Starling curve. So then your function is going to, your TAPSE and your function is going to look worse. Because you start to operating on the flat, quote unquote, flat part of the Starling curve, but more importantly, you're operating on a steep part of a diastolic function curve, which means that extra bit of preload is actually reducing your cardiac performance. You basically are become overstretched to the point where the RV can't use that volume that's being delivered to it anymore. And that's when you get things like worsening tricuspid regurgitation. Tricuspid regurgitation in early stages is actually, I would say, you know, quasi-compensatory, because it prevents the RV from being overloaded, but it comes at a cost, right? Because then you have more, you know, organ congestion, you know, venous congestion issues.
So the preload influences measurements like the TAPSE, but not artifactually. I mean, if you see changes there, it is a real change in probably the output of the right heart. If your TAPSE got better because you gave or you took away volume, then the right heart's doing better.
Yeah.
Okay. So you got your TAPSE, and then there are some other tools we could use here. How do you feel about S-prime?
I think S-prime is interesting. It's, you know, largely similar in concept to the to TAPSE, because it's a longitudinal measurement of RV function. The reason that these parameters are appealing is because not only do they correlate well with, not only do they correlate with EF of the right ventricle, but they're also, you know, the 80% of the contractile function of the normal RV is in that longitudinal plane. So that's why this is an appealing measurement. Now, it still has the same sort of benefits and limitations as TAPSE, but you're measuring something that's fundamentally different. You're measuring the tissue velocity of that tricuspid annulus. So in some ways, this may be more reflective of the, you know, contractile function of the heart, because you're actually measuring tissue velocity, but that's my best guess. I mean, I view them very similarly. I think if they don't correlate with one another, then it's probably more likely a technical issue of the way that you measured it rather than a meaningful difference. But there are some studies where, you know, if you give dobutamine to somebody with pulmonary hypertension, the S prime is more likely to be affected than the TAPSE, and that may be more reflective of a, you know, contractile force of the myocardium itself, since you're measuring that velocity. But that's a lot of physiologic hand waving. So for most purposes, I think I would view them as similar. A lot of people that practice critical care, even if they're facile with echo, don't necessarily have tissue Doppler as part of their workflow. I'm not necessarily saying you have to have it, nor am I saying it's difficult to do, but I think for that purpose, I think TAPSE is good enough for most purposes.
Yeah, I guess in principle, I could imagine a chamber that's contracting fast, but not a lot, or, you know, vice versa. I mean, I feel like you see that in the left heart. You look at an LV and you're like, it seems very sluggish, but actually the EF is not that low, or vice versa.
Yeah.
And so maybe the same thing applies here, but I guess it's kind of hard to know. And it's probably those are niche cases. And even then, I don't know which one matters more and so on.
Agreed. And I think the other thing that's important to point out is both of these items are not only are they load dependent, so they're dependent on the loading conditions, but technically they're angle dependent. So if your angle of incination changes, the way you're, you know, angling the probe towards the tricuspid annulus, you will get different measurements. So I think the key here is if you're going to use S prime, let's say over TAPSE, you need to do it consistently every time. Otherwise, you're going to mislead yourself. Yeah,
and that's one of the arguments I've heard for S prime, that while they're both dependent on getting a reasonably, you know, in line view of the chamber, maybe S prime is a little bit less so than TAPSE. I don't know. Would you agree with that?
I suppose it's possible. I don't know that I can recall off the top of my head whether I can say that's been demonstrated or not.
But in either case, if the main thing you're getting, and I think this is probably true for all these, the most utility is probably in trending things, right? A spot measurement of any of this, other than the extremes, like this guy's got a normal right heart or it's totally messed up. It mostly you want to see, you know, changes in condition or response to therapy and things like that. So then in that case, even if you were way off, as long as you're consistently way off, either could be useful.
Yeah. I think being consistently, consistently inconsistent, is probably better than being inconsistently inconsistent. Right.
What about the RVSP? Is there utility here to measuring or kind of approximating the PA systolic pressure, you know, using echo parameters, because I think it's intuitively appealing to a lot of people if they want to ask questions like, you know, is there pulmonary hypertension in this acute setting and so on. But when you really get down to it, I don't know if people really know what to do with the answer, especially when there is so often a, you know, a chronic element to this.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things that need to be considered. I think, you know, when you go to the bedside and you ask people what they think, what does a pulmonary artery systolic pressure mean? You get a variety of different answers. And that's kind of concerning in and of itself, because I think I don't know that we necessarily can agree as a critical care community what we're talking about. Like, what does this number mean? And I think a good way to illustrate that is people, you know, in my experience, people treat all forms of pulmonary hypertension as being the same, right? So if you have a high PA pressure, should we put you on sildenafil? I'm like, well, you know, we actually have to phenotype this disease a little bit. And RVSP doesn't help you phenotype the disease, whether it's a pre-capillary, post-capillary, or combined issue. So is it helpful to know the PA systolic pressure or the RV systolic pressure is elevated? I suppose, you know, getting at some degree to the, you know, afterloading conditions for the heart, but it doesn't tell you why they're high, right? You could have a high RVSP because your left atrial pressure is 35, or you could have it because you have a pulmonary vascular resistance of 10, and those are very different patients and you apply treatments to them very differently. So that's where I worry about that a little bit. I mentioned this concept of RVPA coupling earlier in TAPSE. Most people use, I guess people that actually use this, which is a minority, use the ratio of TAPSE over PA systolic pressure as a surrogate for RVPA coupling. It's a rough surrogate. We'll have a paper hopefully out about this soon. It's a rough surrogate for, you know, gold standard RVPA coupling at best. And it introduces error now, because now instead of just measuring TAPSE, which you may mismeasure, you're going to measure RVSP, which you may mismeasure. Most of the time, it's going to be underestimated, if anything. But the other thing you have to consider is it relies on not only that tricuspid valve gradient, but it also relies on the right atrial pressure estimation. And a lot of people will estimate the right atrial pressure based on the IVC dimensions, even when the patient's on mechanical ventilation, in a situation in which that's never been validated. So a lot of the times people on mechanical ventilation get called to have a right atrial pressure of 8 or 15 on echo, because they tend to have more dilated IVCs because of the increased resistance to venous return from mechanical ventilation. That causes problems. The other place that causes problems is if you do have a patient with established pulmonary hypertension, their IVC may be remodeled and it may always be plethoric. As an example, I had a patient post-liver transplant with pulmonary arterial hypertension on 3 medications who came out of the OR and had some bleeding issues. They did an IVC assessment when she was off the ventilator, and they estimated it at 15 because she had this, you know, 3-centimeter IVC with no variation. But her invasive central venous pressure was -2. So very, very different. So that term introduces a lot of error, the right atrial pressure term. So if you want to use this in critically ill patients, you should probably actually measure the CVP rather than using the IVC dimensions, because you have the ability to do that. If the patient's sick enough, they probably have a central line or a PA catheter. Or if you don't have that ability, then maybe you just trend the tricuspid valve gradient as a measure on its own. So say the trans-tricuspid gradient is 50. I gave a therapy and now it's 35. Okay, that was probably helpful. Doesn't matter that you don't know what the real PASP number is. It just matters that the treatment affected the patient in the way you wanted to or not.
Right. I was going to say maybe you could just assume some fixed value for the CVP and not change it. But of course, the CVP could also fluctuate with these therapies, right? If the RV starts squeezing 100%. Harder, maybe the CVP goes down and so on.
Yeah, or if you're removing volume or all these other things, like there's a lot of ways it could be dynamic. Right.
Okay, yeah. So you talked about using the TAPSE compared to the PSP. This is not more measurements. I mean, we just talked about each in isolation. So in someone who is capable of measuring both of these, do you think this would be the ideal kind of one marker for assessing function of the RV, you know, in the critically ill patient in shock, for instance?
It's hard to say. There's a lot of papers out now that use this TAPSE over PASP as a outcome predictor. So you say, okay, patients with a, you know, low TAPSE over PASP do worse than patients with a high TAPSE PASP. It's not been validated as a therapeutic target. And like I said, it's only indirectly probably valid as a measure of RVPA coupling. So because there's error introduced, the more measurements that you introduce into a formula, the more chances for error you have. I mean, I tend to shy away from it a little bit. I'd rather just if I am constrained to just using echo in a patient with RV dysfunction or pulmonary hypertension, I'd rather use the TAPSE or a measure of systolic function, because again, it will integrate both of those factors without having to measure this other dimension, which is fraught with error. You know, the other thing is if you have very severe tricuspid regurgitation, the valve gradient is going to be less. But it doesn't mean the RVSP is actually less. It just means what you're measuring across it is less. So there's a lot of ways that sicker hearts may invalidate some of these measurements. So I'm just a little bit cautious about combining the terms, even though it's very popular in the literature right now.
Right. Because even if in principle you're getting some more diagnostic utility from combining two data points, if each one introduces more error, then you might actually end up worse than you started off.
Exactly.
Well, so I just conceptually help frame this, because I think it's useful to keep comparing to the left heart where people are more comfortable. I mean, you could say the same thing about the left heart, right? You could compare the EF to, I don't know, the SVR or the systemic blood pressure, really. That would be very simple to do, but we don't usually do that. I mean, perhaps we should be, but why is kind of accounting for both of these variables more important for the right heart?
I don't know that it is more important. I just think it's easier to do. If you think about RVPA coupling and we're measuring it either by TAPSE or TAPSE over PASP, that's fairly simple because those measurements are everyday measurements. If you want it, you can measure the same things on the left heart, but it's very complicated.
Would it not just be the EF over the systolic blood pressure?
So in this case, the EF is an integration of LV arterial coupling. So the EF itself is a reflection of, so you actually don't, it's just like TAPSE, like you could use it in isolation. You just don't understand the individual components. You don't understand how much of this is because of contractility and how much of this is because of afterload.
But isn't that the TAPSE too?
Exactly. Yeah. So you can, but so if you, you can still use it to monitor therapy, I guess is my point, but it won't tell you what the problem is. So you, there are ways to do this on the left side. It's easier to do. It's actually easier to measure the sum term for SVR that's probably a little bit more useful is called effective arterial elastance. And that's very easy to do on the left side. Actually, you just have to take the systolic blood pressure times 0.9 divided by stroke volume, however you want to measure stroke volume, a PA catheter, an echo, whatever. So that term is fairly easy. So if you just wanted to measure that, you could tell, is this high or low? And then if it's very, very high, then maybe I try to lower it. But the other side of the term, the contractility term, which is elastance at end systole or EES, is very complicated. You have to measure multiple dimensions of the LVOT, VTI, the pre-ejection time, the EF, it's very complicated. So that's very unappealing because you have to have beautiful views. Then you have to have EKG leads on your point of care machine, which a lot of people don't have. So you can say, okay, why would I do all that? I can just look at the change in EF. Okay. So that's why I would make the same argument for the TAPSE, right? So you say, why am I going to go through all this trouble? Because there are also ways to estimate the arterial elastance for the pulmonary circulation, but it's much easier to say, okay, what's happening with the TAPSE?
What about looking in the pulmonary arteries in the outflow tract there and asking questions like, what is the acceleration time of this kind of PA ejection, or is the waveform notched at all?
I think that's very useful. If you can get the views, you should be measuring this in a patient with RV dysfunction, pulmonary hypertension. The acceleration time of the RVOT velocity time integral tells you something about both the pulmonary pressures and to some degree the pulmonary vascular resistance. The shorter that pulmonary valve acceleration time is, the higher the pressures likely are and likely higher pulmonary vascular resistance. If the waveform starts to change where you have notching in it, that's like wave reflection, almost like you see on an arterial line tracing. That's a sign that the resistance is very high. Usually you have to have a PVR in the, you know, 5 or above range to have notching of the waveform. So that's very helpful information, because if you're meeting somebody off the street, you don't know if they have pH or, you know, precapillary pH or not, and you see RVOT notching, that's very helpful. It at least starts to narrow down where's the problem. If there's a RVPA problem, where's the problem? And it's probably a pulmonary vascular resistance issue. And then you just, as a clinician, have to figure out why it's there. Is this pre-existing? Is this an acute PE? Is this related to the way I'm ventilating the patient? Whatever it is.
So you're saying you're not going to get notching from something like elevated left heart pressures?
You should not, no. Not unless it's been present for so long that you have pulmonary arterial remodeling and you have, you know, sort of like the pH of left heart. There's a small subset of patients with pH with left heart disease who get pulmonary vascular remodeling and then their PVR actually increases. But most of the time, it's not going to be the case.
And their acceleration time will not also be so shortened? Or
it can be shortened to a degree. It's usually not going to be as bad as somebody with a pure precapillary. So normal pulmonary valve acceleration time is greater than 130 milliseconds. If you have like, you know, true severe pH, it's going to be in the 50-60 range, like, you know, about half of normal. It's part of that, you know, 60-60 sign that was developed to look at massive PEs, right? So if you have a RVSP less than 60 and a PV acceleration time less than 60, it's more likely a hemodynamically significant pulmonary embolism. And you say, why RVSP less than 60? Well, the reason for that is an otherwise normal right heart that has an acute rise in afterload cannot generate PA pressures over 60, generally speaking. It just, it's not conditioned for that. It's a thin-walled structure. It's just not up to the task.
Some people will measure the VTI through the RV outflow tract. Tell me if I have this right, but it seems like as a general principle, the cardiac output from the left heart and the right heart is equal. The VTI may not be quite equal because it's not the same size outflow. But so there's no utility in measuring each of these like individually and comparing them. It doesn't say that your right heart is in failure compared to your left heart or something. It's just two different ways of getting a number. So if you can get a better view here than of the LVOT, you could do that. But it's not saying anything different. Does that sound right?
That's right. There's some discrepancies in the literature about what the normals are for RVOT VTI. Like for LVOT VTI, we know normals like around 18 to 22. Some references will give 18 to 22 for the RVOT VTI. Some will say lower, like 14 to 16. This is, again, one of those instances where measure what you have to start with and then remeasure after you apply a treatment and see if it changes. But yeah, I think sometimes you get an RVOT VTI, you don't get an LVOT VTI for technical reasons, and it would be a reasonable thing to trend because you're right. Law of conservation of mass, you can't lose cardiac output somewhere along the circuit.
Let's try to tie this together a little bit. But first, are there any other tools that I have not mentioned for assessing the right heart?
Yeah, one thing I think if we're talking strictly non-invasive devices or techniques, there's one other measure or there's two other measures of RV function that are worth knowing about. Whether you're going to use them or not is a different story. So there's a measure called fractional area change, which is the area of the RV in systole versus diastole. And that's, again, trying to approximate an EF measurement. And the reason that that might be helpful is some patients with more advanced right heart dysfunction or chronic right heart dysfunction, they may have okay looking tapsy, but their radial function or how well the RV free wall moves towards the septum is impaired. So that's a better way to capture that. The problem is you have to get really nice views in order to get that, because you have to be able to see the RV free wall, which, as you both I'm sure know, is not usually easy to do in critically ill patients. The other thing that's important to know about, because it's becoming more and more prevalent in the literature, and I'm sure will make its way to our point of care machines, is strain measurements. So strain is another, you know, it's deformation of the, you know, speckles of the myocardium. And that is a useful measurement. It is still load dependent. So it still depends on the afterloading conditions of the heart. But the nice thing about it is not angle dependent. So in theory, you could do it from many angles. You could even do it from, there's even some papers doing it subcostally, doing subcostal RV strain. So as our technology gets a little bit smarter and does a little more work for us, we may be seeing those things more than we see these traditional longitudinal measurements.
Okay, so let's try to put this all together in some way. Let me describe a approach which is probably pretty close to what I do, but you tell me if you think this is kind of touching on all the bases that we've discussed here. First of all, nothing that we have so far described says anything about whether the function of the right heart is adequate, right? So if you say that the heart is dilated or it's contracting poorly or the pressures are high or low or whatever, that doesn't necessarily mean this patient is in shock, right? So correct. The first step should probably be decide if you think this patient is in cardiogenic shock, right? Which might be something you decide clinically, or if it's useful to measure markers of this, whether it's through thermodilution or VTI through one of your outflows or whatever else you're into, and decide if you think that the flow is not enough. And then if you think it's not, then these other factors become more important. But if it is, then, I mean, you could say that, you know, just like the patient with the EF of 10 who is not in shock, you know, it's important to know about because they're probably at risk for it and so on. And the patient who has a terribly strained RV who's not in shock, you should know about that too. But it's not necessarily causing a problem. Is that a good starting point?
I think so. I think starting with perfusion first is always the right idea. Like, is this patient clinically in shock? That makes total sense. And then you have to decide, is the cardiac output adequate or not? I think that's a great place to start. Because if you answer those questions in a way that doesn't make you need to look for cardiogenic shock, you save a lot of time.
Because any number you can get, no matter how accurate, will not necessarily answer that. I mean, the person with the cardiac output that's super low, same situation. Okay. Is it fair to say that looking for signs of dilation is a good sort of screen, that there may be something going on, but per se is probably not going to be super actionable? It's not going to so much differentiate how severe this situation is. It may or may not respond super directly to therapy. It's not going to say much about where the problem is.
Yeah, I think that's right. If you don't have at least moderate dilation, you're probably going to rule this out as a contributor, right? I think it's unlikely that you're going to have sort of a smaller normal RV and have that be the cause of shock.
Yeah, okay. So yeah, it's the D-dimer of RV echo.
Yeah.
No, I guess we should maybe just call out the less common but real situation of like an RV infarct or ischemia. If the primary problem is in the contractility of the RV and not in its afterload, does that change how some of these things are going to present?
I think for the main issues we've talked about, it really shouldn't, except you're not going to see signs of high afterload, most likely. So you're going to see your, you know, tapsy is going to be low, your RV is going to be dilated, you will potentially have clinical signs of hypoperfusion, you will potentially have signs of venous congestion. Otherwise, I mean, I think those are the essentials, but you wouldn't want to start, you know, looking for, you know, you would be surprised if there was high pulmonary afterload in that case, I guess is the way I would say it. So the things that are associated with pulmonary afterload, I wouldn't necessarily think about as much unless you think there's more than one problem going on.
Okay, so then maybe step two is trying to assess for contractility. So some combination of eyeballing the RV, tapsy, maybe S prime to get a sense for how well you're contracting. And then maybe asking what the afterload is like. So if you can look at that RVOT and look at the acceleration time and look for notching. And then kind of comparing those two things to get some idea for the afterload versus the contractility, understanding that they're not separate. I mean, they do overlap. The loading conditions affect the contractility, and the contractility affects the afterload. I mean, if you don't eject, then maybe your pressures are lower as well. But maybe giving you some idea of those different variables, because what we want to know as clinicians, usually, if we decide this patient is in cardiogenic shock from the RV, is what should we do about it? So if we think that we're not contracting enough, then maybe we're going to do something like offer more inotropes that might target the right heart, maybe try to affect the preload. And if we think that's more of a afterload problem, then we could try to target that with maybe things like pulmonary vasodilators or doing other things to their milieu, like their mechanical ventilation and so on, to target that. But with those kind of separate assessments, we can kind of isolate those, even though not really.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so I think I just want to call attention again to the fact that, you know, our measurements of RV systolic function are integrations of the contractility and the afterload. So it doesn't really tell you where the problem is. Even if the TAPSE is terrible, it could be because the PVR is, you know, 10 or something. So I think most of the time, a critically ill patient with a dysfunctional RV, it's usually an afterload problem, unless you think there's an RV infarct or an isolated RV cardiomyopathy or something like that. So think about dealing with the afterload first, because also that's usually energetically less expensive way to get improvement in cardiac function compared to like flogging a heart with an inotrope.
And I guess we should say that there's interdependence here, but it's not totally symmetrical. Poor contractility could be mainly from a high afterload, but a high afterload can't be from poor contractility.
I have to look at it. Correct, yes.
So if, you know, if there are signs of high pressures, we can't, you know, we can't blame a failing RV for that. It's really, it'd be the other way around, if anything else. But, and I guess it's fair to say that regardless of where you think your primary problem is, you can and perhaps should still try to act on both sides of this. I mean, you optimize everything you can optimize, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I think it's still helpful to have some sense for the problem, especially in our typical ICU situation where things are kind of multifactorial and there's several things going on. You can kind of try to, I guess, triage or prioritize your problems or try to figure out what is most acute compared to maybe their chronic milieu. Do you think there's a important role for more invasive monitoring here? I mean, in a patient like this, would you routinely try to measure CVPs, for instance, or do you think it can really be helpful still to get a SWAN in them?
Yeah, I think it depends on I try to match the invasiveness to the severity of illness and the reversibility of the illness. So if somebody's got like a, you know, end stage RV and there's not an out for them, like, you know, either you've optimized what you can, they're not a transplant candidate, they're not a bridge to transplant candidate with ECMO or something, like, then okay, let's pump the brakes, let's work with simpler things. A lot of these patients are going to have central lines anyway because they're going to be on vasoactive medicines. So I think it's, you know, CVP is for free in that case. Not only the number, but the waveform is useful. And the way the waveform changes as the RV conditions change is useful. I mean, obviously I'm biased. I work in a right heart cath lab, so I like pulmonary artery catheters. I think they're useful to titrate therapies and to do serial measurements, right? Because the echo is wonderful, beautiful, excellent, but you know, you have to go back and repeat it all the time. And you have to hope that your repeats are the same and you have the people around that can do it. You know, if one of you guys are on shift, but then shift ends 2 hours later and then somebody else takes over for you and they're not as comfortable with echo, then it's maybe not going to be the right tool. So I think some of the choices of the tool depend on who you work with, where you work, and what they're comfortable with. If everyone's great at echo, you could probably get by with echo in a lot of patients. But if they're not, I think you need to consider being more invasive. But that being said, in 2024, there's a lot of people who are not comfortable with pulmonary artery catheters, and they either won't touch it or they don't necessarily know what to do with the information. So I think it's all about titrating the devices you use to, again, the severity of illness, the reversibility of illness, but also to the comfort and the skills of your team.
I think that's a good point, right? This is the one argument I always make in favor of still occasionally using the PA catheter is that, you know, even if you're not super comfortable with the data it gives you, it's real easy to tell the nurse, you know, titrate this drug according to this number, right? Versus I have to come back and constantly re-echo, or like you said, maybe, you know, maybe the person who takes over for me is not comfortable with Echo. And I think that's a challenge that we're seeing in critical care, is just making sure that everybody has the same skill set and the same comfort level with some of these, especially the newer technologies, right?
Absolutely. And yeah, and the other thing is, you know, just because you have a pulmonary artery catheter doesn't mean it's going to provide you information that's useful or that you will use it in a useful way. There are some places, there are some people who are afraid to wedge a catheter. And if you're not going to wedge a catheter, I can't tell you what the pulmonary, I can't tell you where the problem is. So in that case, it's a little harder to know what to do with the data. That at that point, it becomes a cardiac output monitor, which there's probably other ways you could do that, which I'm not saying that's not useful. In fact, it kind of hurts me a little bit when people put in a pulmonary artery catheter, but don't measure the cardiac output at critical junctures. Cause like, what are we doing here?
Is if you can directly measure the pulmonary artery pressures with a Swan, are you still getting separate additional information by looking at the PA waveforms, which, I mean, I guess you could use the waveform from the catheter. You don't need the echo. But is it still saying something different if you measured, say, their acceleration time or things like notching? Is that saying something about their resistance that is different from the numbers alone?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the, you know, in the case of the non-invasive technology, you know, the echo technology, it's hard to estimate the resistances without those measurements. But if you have the catheter in place, you know, the waveform, the PA waveform is not going to tell you a ton. Basically, there's probably a lot that we can learn from the PA waveform, but not the way that we use it, because it's just a number and a squiggle on the screen. But you can't tell, like, what is the slope of the acceleration? You know, what is the slope of, you know, upstroke of systole look like versus diastole? And there's probably more, you know, outside the scope of, I think, today's talk. There are catheters that allow you to measure RV pressures directly rather than just the PA pressures. And then there's some really interesting information there, especially if you measure both the RV pressures and the PA pressures at the same time. Some nice papers by Andre Deneau from Montreal about RV pressure monitoring cardiac surgery. They have a lot of waveforms that you can see how things change as the RV function changes. So there's a lot to know, a lot to learn from the waveforms if you can integrate all those different data points. But I think if you have a PA waveform and you're simultaneously seeing the CVP waveform, you can get a lot of that information. But you just have to know what you're looking for.
All right. Well, great. I mean, we really kind of circled this topic from most of the angles, I think. What else do you want us to know and think about?
I think the most important thing is, you know, where we started is assessing the perfusion and determining whether or not we even need to go down this road, because there's a good amount of dysfunctional RVs out there that are bystanders and not causing the problem. But if the problem is there, then I think you need to be systematic in the process. So look at the size, the squeeze, the septal kinetics. And then really most importantly, as I've said, you know, probably too many times, is just remeasure after you make a change, because you need to know if your treatments are helping or not. Because things like blood pressure are probably going to be too blunt of an instrument to tell if you made the difference you want. And then once you see, okay, I made the TAPSE go from 1.4 to, you know, 1.9, don't stop there and celebrate, right? Reassess the perfusion, see how the patient's doing. Nobody cares if their TAPSE got better. They care if they get out of the ICU.
Yeah. And I guess I really feel like a lot of people's approach to hemodynamics and cardiogenic shock, it can be kind of blunt. It's like, oh, you know, chamber's not squeezy enough, make it squeeze harder, that kind of thing. And I feel like you just can't understand the right heart without viewing it as this interplay of you know, the myocardium, but also it's the loading conditions that it's within. Because it just kind of doesn't make sense. And really, it's almost more about the loading than the heart, because the heart is just fundamentally weaker there.
Right.
So if nothing else, getting people to kind of think about the heart in this way, I think is useful for all situations, even if you're dealing with the left heart. It's sort of forcing people to have a more nuanced take on it than they otherwise might.
I agree 100%. And similarly, like if you have a dysfunctional left heart, it's really nice to focus on the afterload first, because that's a sort of an energetically favorable way to try to increase cardiac output. So it works the same on both ways, or on both sides. There's just nuances to each.
Brian, what else?
Well, I was going to say, I think tying this back into what we were talking about a minute ago with the varying skill sets and stuff, I find that when talking about POCUS in general, and this is true of any sort of, if we want to call it disruptive technology, right, is that there's going to be people who are resistant to, you know, and I'm not even talking about, like, everybody knows those people who are like, well, I learned it this way in school 20 years ago and I've never changed since. But I'm talking about people who are perfectly fine adapting, but they're like, you know, this is really kind of getting, kind of high level, and I don't know that I really want to get into learning all this stuff. It's getting really technical. And I think a lot of times they make what is probably not an unreasonable argument, especially given what you just said about, you know, is the right hurt the bystander or the cause, is, you know, if I'm going to go to the trouble of learning all this stuff and to do all this stuff, how much difference does it really make? Is it worth it? And am I going to see enough of these to make it worth my time to learn it? And then also to be able to stay proficient at it. So, I mean, I guess what do you say to that? Like, you know, is this something that the average intensivist is going to use enough to make it worth their time? Or is it something that we say, well, if you're in specialized centers or if you're in this type of population, it's worth it. And otherwise, just it's interesting and that's fine.
You could certainly make an argument that in specialized centers, you need to be even more advanced than sort of the things that we're talking about. But it's getting harder, I think, to make an argument to say that you shouldn't have an understanding of, you know, I would call this not even advanced echo. I'd call, you know, maybe RVOT VTI is advanced, but if we're talking about taking, you know, chamber size estimation and adding TAPSE to it, this is like basic plus echo. It's 2024. I don't know how to take care of patients if I don't know what's wrong with them. I mean, I know there's a lot of people who are comfortable just saying, oh, let's just start dobutamine and see what happens. Mm-hmm. I don't like it when I don't know what I'm treating, and I don't like it when I can't monitor my treatment. And I don't think that we, as a society, I don't think that people should accept that because you work in a medical ICU that the patient that comes in with is hypotensive, it has just sepsis and just give antibiotics and 30 per kilo and call it a day. That being said, you know, how many patients, your point is well made. How many patients is this going to move the needle on? I don't know. It's probably, you know, 20% of the 30% of the people that we see. But that's a lot of people because we take care of a lot of patients, yeah. Right? So there's a lot of people who come in and they just do have urosepsis and they need a nominal amount of norepinephrine to ride it out. But there's people that are more complicated than that, and they're not necessarily clustered in expert centers and subspecialty ICUs. So it's getting, I hear where you're coming from, and I hear these arguments a lot, but it's getting a little inexcusable not to have advanced hemodynamic skills as a critical care practitioner. I don't care if they're invasive or non-invasive, but you have to be able to phenotype your patient. Otherwise, I don't know how you help these people.
Yeah, and I think sometimes people oversell how complex some of this can be. I mean, if you have the basic tools for echo, you could apply them to whatever. I mean, I can give you like 8 things to measure, but it's just different spots to do, you know, tissue Doppler or pulse wave Doppler or, you know, grayscale echo. And, you know, you can either get a view or you can't. But once you'd have that skill, then it's not, it's just different ways to apply it. If there's a difficult thing to learn other than that initial skill set, which hopefully most of us are acquiring at some point, it's the cognitive part, like understanding how to implement and integrate this information. But that's not an echo thing. I mean, you would have to do that no matter how you're getting your data, if you're going to do it at all. And I think you probably should be, because patients have a right heart, even if you want to ignore it.
Right. You know, right. I feel when it comes to echo, the biggest pushback is not knowing what to do with the data. It's the, I just can't get it. I can't, you know, it's because it is, right? Anybody who's ever done anything with echo knows it's a complex skill to master. Fine tuning, fine movement of the probe, et cetera. The other thing I wonder is maybe we need to upgrade the machines that we have in the ICU. You mentioned earlier, a lot of the POCUS machines that we have in the ICU won't do things like 3D echo, and they won't, you know, you can't hook up an EKG to it. And there's lots of calculations and stuff that you read about in the advanced echo literature that you go, oh, I'm going to try that out. And you go in and you go, oh, my machine won't even do that. Or maybe even worse, that my machine doesn't even really give me good enough images to do that, because it's a machine that's basically designed for placing lines and glancing at the heart once in a while.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of how, you know, the machines I came up with is like those, you know, black Sonosite keyboard ones that, you know, like you can see that there's cardiac motion and that's about
it. Right.
I mean, I think the other thing about technology is, you know, hopefully it becomes more assistive over time. And, you know, there's already these, you know, auto EF programs, and there's auto TAPSE and auto this and auto that. So, you know, as long as we can, you know, keep improving, you know, the ease in which you can obtain this information, the better off we'll be. Because that's the other thing is, like, we, you know, you're right. These things are hard. They require time and mastery. But also, like, it's just inertia, right? It's difficult mm-hmm. to go and take more pictures and do all these things. And so we have to decrease the, you know, sort of barrier to entry there and just make it a little more frictionless, because right now it's a barrier to people not only learning but applying it. And then the other thing is, you know, I think as critical care practitioners, we need to have a full complement of skills. And because sometimes you can't get the information you need from the echo because of whatever reason, technical limitations or, you know, body habitus or whatever it is. And then you need to have a next place to go. You can't just be like, well, I guess we'll just come back tomorrow and see how they're doing.
Right. So whether that's putting in the SWAN or TEE or whatever else.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I guess we could wrap it up there. Thanks for giving us your nuanced take on this. It's a complicated topic. We'll remind everyone this is just our personal opinions, not those of our own institutions. Not meant to be medical advice, just some general education. And we'll talk to you soon.